This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
It's Mike Shope.
We were having a very serious conversation about mayonnaise here.
And the Bulldog.
And don't even talk to me about weed.
On WGR Sports Radio 550.
The Stanley Cup has been won. The offseason is here. Right. The awards night isn't part of the season, is it? Like, we don't have to wait until the awards are passed out?
No.
We can just call this the offseason? Oh. Travis did in his column, so that's what I'll do.
Yeah, it's on. It's time, yeah.
Travis Yost of TSN joining us. Mike Shope and the Bulldog right now on the West Her Hotline. How have you been, Travis? Travis?
Yes.
Hi.
Going, guys?
How are you?
I'm hanging in there. How are you guys doing?
Pretty good. What's the most interesting thing to you? I've read your column about the Blues and trying to tell that story. For us, I think it absolutely has to be Ryan O'Reilly's championship and Conn Smythe Trophy. What about them for you, Travis? What's the story for you that you think you'll get the most use out of?
In a world where everyone is retroactive and, you know, everyone has 2020 hindsight, I think the biggest testament to what the St. Louis Blues did this year is the fact that they were willing to stay the course and stay patient. With a Blues team that was woefully underperforming in the standings. You know, we know NHL general managers, maybe more so than any other, you know, contingent of general managers in any of the four major North American sports, they are very recency biased. And, you know, whatever the standings say, and especially over the last 10 or 15 games, that really dictates if you're a buyer or a seller, or if you're building for the future or building for now. You know, the Blues, it's been exhausted at this point. January 3rd, dead last in the NHL. But I've got to give an abundance of credit to the Blues because, you know, the underlying numbers suggest that St. Louis was a good team in October, in November, in December with some brutal puck luck. And I don't think anyone could have ever foresaw the Blues making this type of Stanley Cup run. But at the same time, I looked back. I wrote a column at the end of January, early February, when TSN released their trade bait board, and you had names like Braden Schenn near the top of the list. And, yep. I remember writing about it as, like, it's a great buy-low candidate for any team because, you know, his numbers individually are much better than you would believe if you just looked at his counting numbers and goals and assists. And that was actually true for most of their skater group. When they naturally rebounded at the end of January, February, I mean, they effectively went on a blistering six-month run. But I think the point here is that it takes a tremendous amount of patience and really strength and fortitude to be the general manager of a last-place team and still say, yeah, we're going to sit tight. We're going to see what happens. We're going to get rid of our coach. We're going to change the goalie. But generally speaking, we're going to keep our core intact and we're going to see what happens over the next 40, 50 games. That proved to be the best bet any general manager made in the entire league this year because not only did the Blues, you know, they win the Stanley Cup and, you know, it's a massive, it is the point of recognition for any team, but the mere fact that they positioned themselves to be the second, you know, to be in that 2-3 spot in the first round in the Central and draw a really, in my opinion, overrated Winnipeg team. And, you know, the pieces kind of fell along as the playoffs progressed. But they put themselves in the position to succeed by sticking with a skating group that really looked quality all year. Yes, better in the second half, no doubt, but still quality all year. And I have to give credit to the front office for being able to stick to their guns there.
I like this patience getting credit because, like, the coach, even if fans don't remember, Mike Yeo, I just looked it up, was fired on November 18th. So it's not like they replaced the coach and then suddenly their results got better. They still had a ways to go before they completely bottomed out. They eventually changed the goalie, and that was a big part of it. And Binnington was not even maybe the most highly touted goalie prospect in their system. He was someone who had been loaned out to the Boston farm team as recently as last year. But he had better numbers this year, so they plucked him ahead of a guy who had more pedigree, and I guess that paid off too.
Yeah, good luck. Like I always say, good luck trying to figure out goalies ever. But, you know, do I still, you know, even after watching this ridiculous run Jordan Binnington went on, we still really don't know what type of goaltender Jordan Binnington is going to be. And I know that sounds outrageous, but, you know, we have seen goalies in the past go on blistering runs and then just kind of regress towards or the other direction, which is goalies get off to incredibly poor starts and end up being quite good as their career progresses. The best example I have is Martin Jones, right? I mean, we talked about Martin Jones years ago. You know, when Martin Jones hit his early playoff runs, he was fantastic. You know, the Sharks made a big play for him. And what did we spend all year talking about this year about Martin Jones? He's the worst starting goalie in the league. It's very hard and takes a long, long time to get a read on goalies. And a lot of this is just, let's be honest, it's just random chance. Can you find a goalie that can get you a quality number of saves over an extended period? You know, scouting goes into it tremendously, but, you know, you can make the argument that, you know, Doug Armstrong staying patient and Jordan Binnington actually being a game changer in net, at least relative to where they were the two biggest moves the Blues made all year. It had nothing to do with what they did or didn't do at the trade deadline or what they did or didn't do in prior free agency. It was the front office sticking to their core lineup and making, you know, they make the coaching change in November, they make the goalie change a month or two later. Those were the biggest data points, which is, you know, that's not what we usually see from a Stanley Cup team. Usually we see the big trade deadline move that puts them over the top or something to that effect. That wasn't the case in St. Louis this year.
With Travis Yost on WGR, I want to slip this point in and then ask you another question. This might be tough to say when you think about it in terms of the Bruins, but they didn't have to play. Winnipeg wasn't good. That worked to their benefit. They didn't have to play Nashville. They didn't have to play Vegas. And then they didn't have to play Tampa. And, you know, a cup run you might need or certainly you'd want kind of a situation like that where some of the best matchups are, you know, pushed aside for you. The Blues, and I think you made this point in your article too about them, Travis, like it was smart but also perhaps fortunate that their winning streak happened when it did and not a little bit later. Because if it's a little bit later, then they might have moved toward. I think a smart team would have moved toward, well, what are we really looking at here? And made those kind of trades. Did the Blues, to the extent that you know, did the Blues stay the course because they knew what those numbers said? And I have the Sabres in mind asking you that, as the Sabres were the opposite of the Blues, a team that was at the top of the standings for a while but did not have that kind of substantive statistical, you know, base.
So it is a fascinating question, and I think the point on St. Louis is this. I can't sit here and tell you that the front office knew that they were getting a much larger, you know, share of the scoring chances or expected goals than the actual goal differential would indicate. And more to that point, right, like that's what I wrote in my article. Like, yes, they went through a three-month stretch where they were consistently 10 to 15 goals expectedly better than the actual goals indicated in the win-loss column, which is a massive differential. But, you know, the point I come back to is you think 30 games of crazy bad luck is impossible. The Blues lived it. And what's to say another 10 games wouldn't have pushed them to the brink of, oh, yeah, we're going to trade Braden Schenn, we're going to move one of our big defenders, and we're going to refire for maybe, I don't know, 2020. I mean, that certainly could have happened. And to me, it tells the story of how you can't pay. Not everything in sports is black and white. Actually, very little in sports is black and white. But if you play the probabilities consistently, sometimes you will lean into some fortune and some luck. When it comes available. And
right.
To the case in point, you know, the Blues stuck the course. They have this crazy rebound in the second half of the year, and it was much more indicative of the quality of the play that we had saw all year from that team. And then guess what happened? Then the playoffs triggered, and you looked at their road. The Blues did not have a hard road to the Stanley Cup. They did not. The Central Division was not good this year. They drew, in my opinion, the weakest of the 16 playoff teams in the first round. They avoided the best Western Conference team, who was taken out because of a comical 5-minute penalty and a horrible penalty kill after that. And, up until Boston, they really never ran into what I would consider as a serious Stanley Cup contender. Now, full marks to the Blues for beating the Bruins, especially on the road. The Blues showed that they were one of the 3 or 4 or 5 best teams in the world. But sometimes you need a little bit of luck. And I point right back to the other equation of, the same point of the season when St. Louis was heading into a first-round matchup with Winnipeg, all we talked about was, how is it possible that Tampa Bay, Boston, and Toronto, only one of those three teams is going to really emerge? And, again, that gets back into the whole divisional playoff format debate that I don't think we want to get into at this point. But, you look at it from Boston's perspective, and it's like, oh, yeah, Boston could have went Toronto, Tampa Bay, Carolina, St. Louis. That is a crazy difficult road, except Tampa Bay was swept in the first round. Right. So there's all of this stuff that you think you can forecast, but at the end of the day, sometimes it is impossible to do so.
Yeah, it's got to fall right. That's right. And then you've got, you already referenced, what happened with Vegas, officiating, impacting it. At least we got through last night's game without anything going really wrong from that standpoint. It had been a story.
They didn't call anything.
Right, that's right. They called the puck over the glass, and like that was it, I think. But
one of us at least should congratulate the Blues for not committing a single infraction in that
right,
game.
Right.
We should congratulate them on that.
At least
I have one prediction along these. I have one prediction along these lines. All of the talk that we have heard about regarding, wow, everyone in the world, in the hockey world, is recognizing that officiating is just at an all-time low. And I'm not talking about the quality of officiating. I'm talking about the issues with the rule book, the officials missing the calls, our general manager's expectations of what officials should and shouldn't call. It's a complete mess, and everyone has recognized it needs an overhaul. I am predicting you are going to be blown away by the amount of mindless and irrelevant tinkering this summer regarding offensive zone draws and, oh, yeah, we're gonna make one tweak to video review and expand it. I can guarantee, as we sit here today, nothing is really going to change with officiating. They're going to make very minor tweaks at the surface because that's what the NHL does. And that's why we're going to be talking about this issue 1 year from now.
Yeah, I can't remember what I saw now that you're already describing something that I saw. The competition committee met and they decided they're going to suggest this at the general manager's meetings. And it's so insignificant that I don't even remember what it was. I just remember reading it going, really? This is the thing you're going to do? Okay, great. Which is
there seems to be almost like a dissonance between what the league and I struggle with this because the league had to come out. I think 3 times the league had to come out in the playoffs and say, "Yeah, we screwed this call up." Like it's not like the NBA where you get this constant 2-minute, final 2 minutes we're going to review every single call and put it out in the public. The NHL almost never opines about officiating unless it is a brutal call. Or unless it requires supplemental discipline. And I believe they had to come out at least 3 times and say, yeah, this got blown. I mean, they parked 2 or 3 different officiating teams for missed calls. And so, to me, that's the league recognizing something is broken here. And yet, collectively, the sport, the NHL, the league as an entity, nothing is going to be proposed in a way that, we can even talk or have the dialogue of serious, significant change about what we expect from our officiating teams. What we expect from the rule book, the rule book has become like the Mueller report in that it exists, and I really only think like 2% of people have read it because this is the one part I'm sympathetic to officials, right? Like, if you actually read the rule book, there would be like 75 penalty calls a game. So you're kind of asking the officials, like, hey, here are the rules, but kind of don't call them, which already puts them in a bind, and then they miss the calls because they're humans. And there may be a quality issue there, too. And it's just a complete mess. And this tinkering stuff drives me up a wall.
With Travis Yost. Travis, I don't want to focus on the divisions here as the answer to this question. We've talked about that before. But thinking about the Sabres and what they have in front of them, and really the bottom line question of how hard should it be, parentheses, how long should it take? How hard should it be? I mean, I look at with the O'Reilly trade so in focus. Come on, Sabres. This has got to be humiliating to them. I would hope so, almost. So, will there be change? Will the Sabres change about how they identify who good players are? Let's say they do. Let's say the Sabres start to maneuver like the way you might recommend they do. So, if they were to start going in that direction, how hard should it be for them to revamp?
I don't think hard at all, but the problem is the competitive advantage of and the market inefficiencies that exist, especially from a data-driven approach, are waning with time. Mm-hmm. More and more teams are getting into this environment. More and more teams are getting into this space. And teams like Buffalo are falling a little bit behind. And it brings me, you know, you mentioned the O'Reilly trade. There's so much nuance to the O'Reilly trade. And, again, we have 2020 hindsight. Now, it's kind of hard to postmortem, you know, it, to be completely fair to all parties involved. But the thing I always come back to is forget the signing bonus part of the equation. Forget the fact that O'Reilly, quote, lost his love for the sport and whatever. And you know, forget all the different pressures. At the end of the day, and you can even throw away the draft picks. At the end of the day, the three players that Buffalo acquired to try and at least stabilize their team, and as, you know, the trajectory of the Sabres organization was supposed to move in the right direction and upwards and towards contention, they acquired Tage Thompson, who, let's just be honest, I think most people missed the boat on Tage Thompson. He just hasn't been good yet. I think there's still time and opportunity. He clearly hasn't played with a lot of talent around him, but he did not have a good season. Vladimir Savoca, who may have been the worst regular NHLer in 2018-2019, I actually think he was number one, and Patrick Berglund, who quit on the team. I mean, those are the three pieces that Buffalo used to quote-unquote replace Ryan O'Reilly in the lineup.
Yes.
A fourth liner, a guy who shouldn't have been in the league, and a guy who quit on the team. That to me is a scathing indictment of them, regardless of how well or how not well they valued Ryan O'Reilly as a player.
Right, and if one of those guys were promising or just good, we could always just focus on that because that's right. What fans want to do.
Right, and the best you can do is, well, maybe Thompson will still become a top six forward. Maybe.
Right.
And I wouldn't even want to bet on that right now, but it just you can't rule it out.
If Thompson had played the entire season in Rochester, we might do the thing I just said.
Right.
Which is, well, we got this guy and he scored 18 goals in Rochester. You know, at least we would feel like we were above water in this, but there isn't that. And now there's a Conn Smythe trophy and a Guinness in our face.
Right. Yeah, the bonus part of it is interesting to consider here. Like I was reading today, Pierre LeBrun went deep on O'Reilly and like revisited the trade, Travis, and was asserting that there's a couple things. Like the thing had been left for dead by the Blues. They signed Bozak and Perron, and I remember watching all this in real time on July 1st, sitting by the lake, just looking at my phone, going, okay, well I guess the Blues are out on O'Reilly because they've signed these guys. And then the way the story's told by LeBrun, Bottrell revisits it, and maybe there's a pressing time concern about that $7 million bonus being due at midnight. And so Bottrell just has to take whatever the only person who wants to even talk to him about Ryan O'Reilly will give him, instead of being able to make the best trade he can.
Yeah, and again, though, all of this goes back to, you know, let's even unwind it even further, right? Like, how did we even get to the point where trading Ryan O'Reilly was a good and viable idea? Like, Buffalo, the Sabres organization, and O'Reilly himself, I mean, there's multiple components here, but at some point, the organization needs to be accountable for, yeah, this guy really didn't want to play here. Now we have Patrick. By the way, Patrick Berglund is a fine NHLer. He is. And maybe the best of his career is behind him. But you're having, like, guys consistently come out and say, like, yeah, whether they're expressly stating they want out or implying they want out, like that to me, like they are adversely contributing to this. And again, the number one thing that cures a lot of that is winning. It's winning, winning, winning. And I know the Sabres, maybe more than anyone, want to turn this ship around and put talent in place to build a winner. But the problem is, it seems like every time they try and do so right now, they get in their own way. And, you know, this is a huge offseason for the team. They, again, have cap space to play with. They have a critical need for forward talent right now. They've got a new head coach who really has an opportunity to kind of right-size how they allocate their defensemen. Like, there is opportunity with this team, again. But will the decision-makers put their best foot forward, and will they make the right decisions? I mean, we watched all year that Sabres team, from a coaching and front office perspective, try and – that was not a talented team. But they were not the least talented team in the league either, and they submarined themselves and they shot themselves in the foot with how they handled their lineup and how they handled their roster. And some of this has to be accountable on the Sabres organization.
If I'm up here when there's time for one question, I'll choose Kevin Durant as the topic. So I was reading Deadspin on this yesterday, and Deadspin put it this way, Travis: one of three things is true about Durant. One is that Steve Kerr is lying when he talks about saying that we thought the most serious injury Durant could suffer is a re-injury to his calf. Two is the Warriors medical staff is incompetent for, you know, telling Kerr and basically going forward with that in mind. And three is that what happened in Toronto is just something that would happen. It could have happened to anyone. Which, unless you can think of a fourth one, which scenario are you buying?
So this is the dangerous part of this, which is there are a lot of people who have suddenly become experts on how calf injuries affect the Achilles.
I'm asking you to be one.
And I am going to tell you that I am not disciplined or intuitive enough to know. I would assume that an injury to the leg makes the likelihood of another injury to the leg more likely. But I don't. That is not a scientific argument because I am not studied in this. But what I will say is this. You can't discount the fact that Kevin Durant wanted to play. And that's the part I've had trouble with, which is the one thing we know is Kevin Durant 100% wanted to play in Toronto. And it lends itself to what you're saying on point three, which is sometimes this stuff just happens and then we try and attribute narratives to it. But at the same time, I also have trouble reconciling that with what should be intuitive, which is if my calf is killing me and I change the way I spin, the torque I put on my leg, you know, the way I jump stop off my, you know, on a dribble drive, like that has to create more pressures on other ligaments and muscles. That little much I do know. And to that end, doesn't it seem likely that he was at further risk of re-injury, broadly speaking, and that he wanted to play and it was his decision? I think those are both right answers.
Yeah, I'm with you on all that. I mean, it wasn't just a leg injury. It was a lower leg injury, like right by.
Correct.
It could be just circumstantial, but I would bet that there had to be some risk and everyone just swallowed hard and went, okay, especially the player, I'll take the risk. It's fine.
Yeah, and let me tell you one thing that I do know. So you forgot bullet four, which is, the only way this ever would have happened is if the Knicks were going to re-sign him 2 months from the day of the injury. That was written by the gods in the sky.
The back page of the New York Post, Knicks lose game 5. It's awesome.
Oh, boy.
All right, hang in there, Travis. Thanks a lot, as always. Maybe we'll talk, I don't know, close to the football season. Catch up then.
All right, sounds good, man. Take care.
Travis Yost of TSN, at Travis Yost on Twitter. Sal is next. Maybe we'll get to Dawson Knox after 2 days of not doing
this.
And field day. My son's got field day coming up. Maybe I could learn something.
Is there
from
a giant slide at his field day?
There should be. Yeah, I'm volunteering at it.
Oh, okay.
So I could maybe learn something from what the Bills were up to today from Sal.
All right.
That's right ahead. Brian Koziol later on first day of the U.S. Open. Tiger Woods has not even started his round yet. It's on the West Coast. Mike Schoep and the Bulldog here. This is WGR.
It's Sal Capaccio.
Sal Capaccio, Sal Capaccio, Sal Capaccio, Sal Capaccio, Sal Capaccio, Sal Capaccio, Sal Capaccio,
on WGR.
Welcome back. A hilarious gag, kind of a running gag here at the station, is me mentioning a random baseball fact to Joe. And then, like, something that happened today, for instance, today I said Nelson Cruz is 3-for-4 with a home run today. And then Joe guesses who he plays for. And I realize Joe always guesses Texas.
Most of the time. Nelson Cruz sounds like a Texas Ranger.
Usually guesses Texas.
He was on Texas when they were in the World Series last. I'm pretty sure he was there.
So that was probably lodged away back in my brain somewhere.
Probably. Sal Capaccio with us. So, Sal, today was not what we expected, or did you kind of think that this might happen, where the Bills would cancel the regular practice to do fun things?
Well, I kind of thought maybe in the back of my head yesterday, because we were originally scheduled to have Josh Allen available to the media today, according to the schedule put out for the week, but then he went yesterday. And it was like, oh, they're moving Josh up. And then there was no, like, specific player that was going to be made available, like Josh. You know, that's usually just Josh. Or there was nothing like that. You know, it switched it up. So I'm thinking, okay, well, maybe. Just for a minute, I thought about it. And then I said to myself, no, like, they're probably going to maximize, you know, what they can get out of it. And then saw the rain and stuff, and then got the text this morning and said, no minicamp. Canceled.
So what did go? Do you have an idea what went on? I'm imagining like you, it's always a big deal when you guys get to watch practice. I'm imagining you didn't get to watch
field day,
wiffle ball, home run derby, and giant slide day.
No, so what's funny about today is I think it's really cool that we don't know because it leaves a lot to the imagination. Like you can kind of think of anything they could do. I have no idea what they did because on top of the fact that there was no minicamp, there was no media availability. So Right. Like they basically told us don't come down there.
It's
what they said. Now, here's my guess. They probably had meetings in the morning and then said, guys, have a good break. See you later.
I don't know. I saw pictures of guys do. Like, I'm not kidding about the giant slide. Like I think they had a field day. I think they played like kids games.
Oh, I have no idea. I mean, where did you see this on Twitter, Instagram?
On Twitter, I saw some photos of slides, and I think I thought I heard Murph say something about wiffle ball.
Well, there you go. I guess that is the case. That was
right.
My assumption early on today was, oh, they're just going to let him go. But yeah, I honestly don't know what exactly they did today.
Yeah.
Potato sack race.
Yeah, I don't know.
Water balloons. What else?
And part of the reason was was that in the field house too? Because I'm thinking with the rain, I'm like, they're not gonna want them outside and stuff like that.
The pictures I saw appeared to be inside the field house, yes.
Okay.
So that makes sense.
We
weren't kidding about field day. Like that's really what happened today, I think. So anyway.
Love field day. Well, we don't have to only talk about field day. I've been wanting for a couple days to feel out where you are with the Bills at tight end.
Yes.
And I'll tell you one of the reasons why is that we have our dynasty draft on Saturday, and Dawson Knox is a guy that, I mean, rookie tight ends usually don't give you anything. Maybe, though, there's potential down the road. Maybe that will be different this year. And it does seem like there could be an opportunity for him. So what are you seeing? What are people saying about him and his chances of helping the Bills this year, even starting?
Well, I think he has really taken advantage of his reps and opportunity here with Tyler Kroft and Jason Kroom both out. He has been the beneficiary, one of them. I'm going to get to Tommy Sweeney in a minute because I think he's been kind of a surprise in this regard. But from Dawson Knox, he's on the field a lot. He gets targeted. They're flexing him out. They're using him in different roles. And I do notice the athleticism when he's out there. It's one thing I happened to see my friend Len Jankowicz out at practice yesterday. He's the former Lancaster High School coach. And we were talking about players. And I said, Coach, when you watch this guy, I said, you could see his athleticism right away. Like, it kind of jumps out off the page. And when he's, you know, there's no pads on. We know that, right? But, you know, when he goes down the seam or something like that, he kind of looks the part, so to speak. But what I have been surprised at, too, it's not just him. It's Tommy Sweeney. Tommy Sweeney's getting a lot of run as well, and that wasn't necessarily the case early on in these OTAs and minicamps, but I see a lot of Tommy Sweeney. The Bills, in fact, I will say, have noticeably had two tight ends on the field a lot, and it's generally them. And a lot of times Lee Smith comes in to make a blocking tight end and another tight end. I think I've even seen three, to be honest with you, once or twice, if my eyes haven't deceived me. But they're all getting a lot of run right now.
So two tight ends in the offense, like that'll be interesting to monitor. One running back, so that'd be what they call 12 personnel, right? One running back, two tight ends, and that means two wide receivers. So are in a two tight end offense, how much downfield, you know, route running is there going to be for, you know, the two tight ends on a given play most of the time?
Mike, it really depends on, even though you might have the attachment of 12 personnel and have two tight ends, so to speak, I think it depends on how you want to use those tight ends because, like I said, they've been flexing out. They've been lining up. In fact, I think Sweeney more than Knox, but I've seen these guys as H-backs. You know, they're putting them in different spots on the field. And maybe that's what minicamp is for. Let's see what they can do. Let's see what we can play with here with these guys on the field. So I think they're trying to create matchups and things like that. So as much as, sure, you know, it's a tight end, quote-unquote, I think they're using them more like a wide receiver a lot of times from what I've seen. They're not really inline blockers and things like that. Mm-hmm. So, it just seems to me like they're going to really both. Well, Dawson Knox is going to make the team. I don't see how he can't, given where he was drafted. Yep. I think Tommy Sweeney's going to make a really big push for this team, given what I've seen now through minicamp, especially, you know, with Jason Kroom being hurt. And he's going to have to make sure he steps up to keep his spot.
And Kroom is one of these, like, just sort of don't worry about it. He'll be back soon. Kroft is, like, into the season. Is that right?
You know, there's a the timeline on that probably puts him somewhere in training camp, Bulldog. So okay. I wonder if he'll be able to do anything. And then you might have to talk about like a putting him on the PUP list, yep. you know, something yep. like that. Right. But again, that's, you know, we don't know the exact timeline there, but it would probably make sense given when he had his broken foot.
Right.
I don't think he'd be ready for training camp, but I do wonder if he'd be doing something at training camp by the time they, you know, get to the regular season. And then you have to wonder about conditioning, playbook, and those kinds of things.
Right. The idea of the two guys and like splitting them out, like that's a lot of what the league is finding that mismatch. And the question is, do you have someone who actually is a mismatch, right? Two tight ends, okay, this probably is running centric, but then they're out wide and like who's going to cover them? And it sounds like Knox has the athleticism to perhaps be a mismatch there. And I feel like Kroom has demonstrated that he's got that. Beyond that, I'm not sure they've really got anyone that I would feel good about in that area.
I think the difference is, though, you know, if Jason Kroom's on the field and I'm a defensive coordinator, a player, I pretty much know he's not going to be a great blocker, right? I mean, they may ask him to do it, and he can do that a little bit, but yeah. he's a converted wide receiver, right? I mean, I think Dawson Knox and Tommy Sweeney, even more than Knox, if they're on the field, they at least pose the threat of maybe they're going to have them block a little bit, so they kind of put you in a bind.
Right.
And Sweeney's actually bigger than Knox, 6'5", 251. Knox is an inch smaller. He's listed at 6'4". They're both about the same weight. He's actually listed 3 pounds heavier, but he's a little bit taller. They do look like the same guy, and one wears 88 and one wears 89. You have to be careful out there to not confuse them.
Right.
It's funny because I do that all the time. I'm like, wait a minute, was that Sweeney or was that Knox? They kind of look like the same player. Now, on the point you just made, though, about where the league is going. So if you watch the huddle, what's interesting is, and I know that Zay Jones has been out and you know, Robert Foster was out this week. But if you look in the huddle, everybody gets together, and all of a sudden it goes, you know, you're looking around, and everybody's kind of around the same level. Josh is a little taller. And then, boom, those wide receivers are like 3 inches smaller than everybody. yeah. And they're all down here, right. you know, looking up in the huddle at everybody. And maybe that's what they need. Maybe they got to balance it out with some of these bigger guys, and maybe they want some of that flexibility to spread guys out, but they need bigger guys because, sure, they want smaller wide receivers, but we at least have to have something of a threat to match up in the bigger area.
Yeah, that's a really good point, maybe. They don't have Kelvin Benjamin for that
right,
anymore.
Right.
So they would want to have that that ability. Very good. Tommy Sweeney, seventh round pick, by the way, out of Boston College, because we haven't talked about him really at all.
No, but I do. I think he's somebody that maybe you should keep an eye on once training camp comes around. It's going to be a battle at that position, and I think Sweeney and Knox are both having a nice spring to show that they deserve a chance to fight for jobs here.
I see Joe writing all this down feverishly. We might see Joe make maybe a sixth-round flyer on Tommy Sweeney in this thing on Saturday, right, Joe? That's how
I could do see need tight ends. So.
I could definitely see Sal picking Tommy Sweeney in the February Fix supplemental yeah. draft. Because Sal will go deep in that thing.
I had some doozies last year. There's no doubt about it.
Mike Boone.
Yeah, Mike Boone.
Who is still a name. Like, he's still somebody. Yeah. Mike Boone.
There you go.
You didn't make
still,
that up.
No, that's right. Minnesota, not here. That's okay. Minnesota.
No, I'm pretty confident he wasn't here. I think I knew that.
I mean, Tommy Sweeney before today, I don't know who that is.
Yeah. You know, Boone Heron was here, though. Remember him?
Oh, do I?
Yes.
Yeah. I do remember that guy.
Dan Boone Heron. He was here.
Yeah. No, yeah, he caught two touchdowns in the Bills' last playoff win.
I'm trying to think of something clever. I don't have it, though. Amazingly, I don't have a clever comment about Boone Heron, what Sal, we did together.
Sal, I think we've taken up enough of your time.
Do you have any clever baseball random facts for today you can share with me?
That I haven't already spent on Joe.
What did you say today? That was the Nelson Cruz thing?
You want a trivia question? Yeah.
Sure, sure.
I'll give you a trivia question. This stumped Andrew Filippone.
Okay. And Andrew's pretty good, so.
Yeah, he is go-to. All right, Cal Ripken's last game was in 2001 against Boston. David Cone was the pitcher, by the way,
wow.
for Boston
yeah. right.
in Ripken's last at-bat. The Orioles had a Hall of Famer on their team who pinch hit that game. He ended up at batting only four times for the Orioles, and they traded for him that season for a specific other reason, not to like help them win games necessarily. Any guesses? Hall of Famer, if I didn't say that. Only batted. You might be able to think of a couple guys who are Hall of Famers, and you think of them maybe with the Orioles. I'm telling you, this guy batted four times
right.
in his career
right,
for
like,
Baltimore.
Like, yeah, Baines eventually played
Baines.
There, but he would have batted way more than four times.
Right. And there was, and the second part of the question is, why did they trade for this guy?
Yeah.
I mean, you said Bates. I'll even say, I think Tim Raines played for them at one point, I think.
Tim Raines is right.
Oh, my gosh.
That's it. Tim Raines is right. And why did they trade for Tim Raines?
Pinch run.
No idea.
Because his son was on the team.
Oh, wow.
And so Raines Jr., Tim Raines Jr., was in the lineup that day for Ripken's final game. Tim Raines Sr. was not, but he was a pinch hitter against Cone. Like, they batted in the same inning, I think, Raines and Ripken.
By the way, the only reason I even guessed him is because it rhymed with Baines, and Bulldog said Baines.
Hey, count it.
So I mean, what about Raines?
You put up a three, you bank it in, it's three.
Rock.
Good team. So.
Rock Raines.
Good teamwork, buddy.
You got it.
Remember the baseball card had Rock on it, Mike? What year was that? It said Rock Raines instead of Tim Raines.
Yeah, there was one of those. Yeah, I don't remember the card. It was probably later on in his career, maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
Rock Raines. Mm-hmm. Man, that guy. In his prime for Montreal, that guy was terrifying. I was a Met fan, and there was a Saturday afternoon game against the Expos at Shea when Raines just, I could look it up. Like, he just did everything. Stealing bases.
Like 85, 86 tops, something like that. I'm going to look it up now.
Said Rock Raines?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, maybe. I'm not sure.
Feel like we had our own field day here, Sal. team building, you and I, we just worked together on that, and we got Baines and Raines.
Yes,
and like,
we did.
I feel good about it. All right, buddy.
Good job on the field day.
All right. Sal on the Western Hotline there with us. His appearance sponsored by New York's only outlet liquor. When you need to stock up, it's the place to buy a case. What's your outlet?
Talked about Ryan O'Reilly at the beginning, and at one point I said, I just feel like I'm obligated to talk about him this one more time because of last night. I mean, just what... What another cruel development for Buffalo sports fans to have O'Reilly win like that this year, the year after he was traded. He was on the Sabres less than a year ago. So we'll do a little bit more of that. It'll be fine. What do you say about, what do you want to say about that happening, the Sabres trading him, this happening at this point? 803-0550. Mike Schoep and the Bulldog will spend most of the next hour or so on the Blues and the NHL. Brian Koziol will come on later. We'll talk about the U.S. Open day one. Tiger Woods tees off in about 15 minutes. This is WGR.
Got another pair of tickets for you to go check out the Zach Brown Band on Saturday. Darien Lake Amphitheater. Minimum value of this prize is $80, courtesy of our friends at Live Nation. General contest rules apply. You can still buy tickets at livenation.com or, again, win a pair right here. Caller 5-644-9878.
Let's talk to David now. Hi, David.
Hey, guys. I got to be honest. I vacillated back and forth. I had huge ambivalence about that game last night. I mean, the thought of Boston winning another major championship made me sick to my stomach, but... You know, the way that O'Reilly left here with the whole, you know, statement about how he lost his passion for the game, I feel like he quit on us. But the thing that's got me the most bummed out is now there's another major sports franchise that is crossed off the list of teams that never won a major championship, and I'm worried that pretty soon the Sabres and the Bills are going to be the only teams left that have never won a championship.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Rich Eisen was tweeting about that today from NFL Network, and he pointed out that the NFL, there's been the least of that, but NBA, there's been that, and here are the Raptors tonight, again with a chance. NHL, I think it is five teams this decade, going back to Chicago's first, that won their first cup or their first cup in decades. And baseball has had some of that, too.
Yeah, the Kings were on that list, too. Yeah, that's right. I don't find myself getting hung up on that that much. I feel good for fans who've never won. You know, St. Louis has been at this a little bit longer than we have, and so and I think it's a underratedly strong hockey market, even though it's in the Midwest, and we tend to think of Northeast and Boston and Buffalo and Minnesota and like that's hockey in America, and I think St. Louis is a strong market for that. So I don't focus on that. You know, the personal stuff, the Sabres being laughed at, hits more home to me. But when it came right down to it last night, like that game is happening and the game begins. And I think I admitted earlier in the finals, I'm a little more torn than I thought I feel like I should be. I hate Boston. Of course I'm rooting against Boston. I even rooted for Toronto against Boston. But as this was going on, this O'Reilly story and the mocking of the Sabres is taking a toll on me, and so I'm a little more torn as I'm watching. Last night, the game starts, and right away, the first thing that happened in the game that I thought was worthy of tweeting about was the number of fans who reacted to a Blues player at the Boston blue line trying to keep the puck in, shooting it out of play. And a bunch of fans down low by that blue line on camera jumped up like pointing, like, that should be a penalty, it should be a penalty. And it's, you know, it's only in the defensive zone that that's a penalty. And I immediately reverted to, I hate these people. I hate Boston fans. For not knowing that. And just what, not just that, but like that reminded me, like, these people suck. They win everything. Screw you. Like, go Blues. Last night, no dilemma about it, just go Blues. I hated the Bruins. I needed to be prodded and reminded, but I hate them.
Bulldog's like, take a minute to learn the rules. And the Boston fans are like, I got another parade. I don't have time for that.
Who has time for your stupid rules?
I have to watch the Super Bowl again.
Me and Sean got to go to the duck boats.
Ugh. I do like the duck boats. All right. Thank you, David. 803-0550. There are a lot of these teams having a lot of fun, including some that have lost in the finals. Sharks, Predators, Vegas in recent years. That seems like a pretty good party. Must be nice. Mike Schoep and the Bulldog here. O'Reilly and how it feels. And what do we think the Sabres can do from here? It's got to be pretty embarrassing. We'll talk about that. Join us here on WGR.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.